Welcome back to the Film Experience Podcast. I'm your host, Nathaniel, and I'm here once again with Joe Reed from The Wire, Katie Rich from Vanity Fair, and Nick Davis from Nick's Flick Picks. And this week we're going to be talking about Hunger Games, Catching Fire, and Philomena. This was actually recorded last week, but we talked so long we had to divvy it up into two podcasts. Okay,
Okay, Philomena.
welcome
Sorry.
back to the podcast. This one's going to be a quickie. We're going to talk about Hunger Games, Catching Fire, and Philomena.
And only one of us is going to live through this podcast, so.
If it comes down to that, I am going to threaten with poison berries, because we
Start
all have to make it out alive.
Well, but
I
I
read
have.
at the end of this one, way more of us survive than you would think because we all get our left it out at the end.
Spoiler.
Yeah, spoiler
Sorry.
alert, Joe.
Oh, who hasn't seen this movie by now and/or read the book? It's made all the money.
I have not.
There is no money left to make because Hunger Games has made all the money.
I have not read the books, actually.
Oh, that's fine. You saw
So
the
when
movies.
people keep talking about Julianne Moore's part in the next movie,
Yeah.
the boyfriend tells me, who has read the books, he tells me, "Oh, that should have gone to Michelle Pfeiffer," which made me crazy because now I'm like curious what the role is.
He's
Yeah,
like
kind of between your
gaslighting you.
loves.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
He just whispers that in your ear while you sleep. It should have been Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah. You know, he's not like me, so he's not just constantly bringing out Michelle Pfeiffer for no reason.
He needs a
Except
good
maybe to get what
reason.
he wants. That's what I would do. Do you mind getting my laundry? I love Michelle Pfeiffer.
I still, this one job I had like 10 years ago, the people who knew me at that job, who I'm still acquainted with, still tease me about it. One of them, apparently on her first day in the job, and I had only been there a week too, I asked her if she liked Michelle Pfeiffer. I don't remember this conversation at all, and people were still teasing me about it. She's like, "It was so random, this person at work asking me if I liked this actress."
Well, you get old enough and you just want to know when people are on your side early, you know? I'm
Draw the
forming a
lines
questionnaire
early.
myself.
Okay, so Hunger Games: Catching Fire. I will start because I'm less freaked out and excited about this franchise than Joe, who seems to know everything about it. I don't know the rest of your feelings.
Joe and I both had to issue apologies to actors in
We
this
did.
movie
That's
because
true.
we were convinced they would be terrible and then they were actually pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, since I hadn't read any, well, I hadn't read any of the books, so I had no expectations of what about who should be cast, but I did think the casting was really strong, especially in the second movie.
Yeah, they did a good job, I have to say, for as much. Katie, did you get Sam Claflin retweeting your apology?
No, you
That's
clearly had the higher profile apology because I
apparently.
apologize to Sam Claflin because I was not convinced he could make a good Finnick because he was awful in everything else I'd ever seen him in.
What
And
else
then he
has
was
he been
actually
in?
pretty good. And then Jenna Malone was actually pretty good as Johanna, which is, I mean, Finnick and Johanna are probably the most fun characters in the entire series, so they had a lot of pressure on them.
Yeah,
And they were both
Johanna
pretty good.
was my girl throughout those last two books, and it's not that I don't like Jenna Malone, but she's
Spoiler
a very
alert!
specific type. Wait,
Spoiler alert,
what?
you mean she survives the next two books as well?
Well, there's only
Well,
one
there's
book.
only one
One
more
more
book
book
left.
after this. It's
Oh,
two movies, but it's
that's
one.
right, that's right.
Yeah. Jenna Malone's a very specific type of actress, and she's played a very specific type of characters, and none of them seemed to be able. I couldn't reconcile any of them with the character that Johanna has to be, but she did a phenomenal job in the movie, I thought. And so I said so in very apologetic terms, which apparently were not apologetic enough for the internet, because once Jenna Malone retweeted that article, I got so many people with Hunger Games characters as handles on Twitter being like, "You're a smug asshole. I can't believe," or like, kind of like kissing up to Jenna Malone, being like, "I thought you were going to do a great job from the very beginning." So it was just like, "Well, congratulations. Congratulations at Katniss girl. Like, you got it. You really nailed it." I thought she was great. I still think Jennifer Lawrence is fantastic in these movies, and I think maybe even better than some of the things she gets a lot of praise for otherwise.
You know, I'm realizing that with her, she's going to be one of these actors where it turns out her Oscar win is for my least favorite performance of hers.
Very well could be, but I think there's something she holds these Hunger Games movies together for me so much more.
Yeah, I don't know if these movies would work without her,
I don't
honestly,
think they
because
would.
there are so many things written into that character in the books that just drive you crazy by the end of it. Yeah. She's got this ongoing internal monologue, and she's constantly convinced she's going to die, and you know she's not going to die. And Jennifer Lawrence just gets so much of that out of it without any of the awfulness. She's amazing.
Yeah, I feel like the movies are quite a bit better for me than the books, especially the second one. I think the second movie is so much better than the first movie, and the first book to me is a good bit worse than the second book is a good bit worse than the first book. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that disparity now in the second one, I just had such a good time with this movie. And I thought they really get across things that the book maybe doesn't even. I feel like the character of PETA is a much better realized on the screen, where you just sort of are free to realize that, like, oh, like, he is the lesser of these two guys, but she ends up, like, needing him anyway. And there's, like, a whole added dimension where in the books it's just sort of like, this guy or that guy, who does she like? And
yeah.
Well, what I liked about them, and I haven't read the books, is that it didn't seem like that, you know, Team PETA, Team Gale thing didn't even seem like all that important. Like, it's not as, like, teen angst romance bullshit as other things of its ilk. Like, yeah, because that's not really the focus, you know?
Yeah, and she's not that interested in that. Like, right. her engagement in the love triangle is less than the fans of the books.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so that's totally another thing I really like about her performance, too, is that she's really smart about the performance, I think. Because she's really not focused on the men, even when the men are right in front of her.
Right.
Her mind is sort of always distracted, which I think is like a smart move. Anyway, she's a good movie star. She's great in American Hustle too.
Stop talking about American Hustle.
Sorry. Nick, I haven't ever heard your feelings about The Hunger Games.
I kind of just I read the first book and saw the movie after I'd done that, and then I've decided not to read more of the books, and so I just saw the movie by itself this time.
Uh huh.
I just kind of don't get it. Like, I just kind of don't get it. I don't really get her in it that much. I feel like it is, like, this movie in particular just seemed like such a, it had the, like, unenviable, to me, like, the transitional Two Towers problem of, like, mm-hmm. It's just to get us from the beginning to the end. And, like, when the big thing that happens at what I thought was the middle of the movie, like, when things start falling from the sky, I was like, oh, good, now the movie can start. And I thought that was going to be the beginning of an act three that the whole thing had been building toward, but it turned out, I mean, that's true in a sense, but only insofar as you have to wait for a whole third movie. Like,
and that problem will be extended since the last movie is two movies.
Yeah.
Well, clearly. And, like, I don't know, I feel like I've now watched two movies where everybody talks about how sort of fearsome and violent and everything this is, but I've never once watched Katniss have to really kill anybody or do anything difficult in a way that the camera even sort of treats, like, and that was even more intensified this time. Like, everybody who they actually do have to kill off, like, gets killed off in, like, little third of a second
and long shot, yeah,
cutaways.
And in long
it
shots,
never,
too.
Ever, ever feels to me in these movies like anybody is actually going to die who you can't already see coming when and how that will happen. Usually the camera doesn't go anywhere near it. I don't have any sense that any revolution is actually fomenting. I don't believe this world at all. Like, I just think that the design scheme of the movie is so insane, and from costumes to sets, it just doesn't seem like a unified vision of a world at all to me, and that just continually throws me out of taking seriously anything they're telling me to take seriously about it. Like,
mm-hmm. See, I feel like this movie does a lot better job of creating that world than the first one did.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. They took the extra budget and they really put it into making this look like a real place. I don't know that I still don't know that it totally looks like a real place. I mean, there's a lot of CGI. There's a lot of just spaces that don't feel real. But I did appreciate what they were able to do with a little bit of extra money to build, even like give Elizabeth Banks better costumes.
Well, I sometimes get dinged for this when I wish that, you know, certain things were TV series instead of movies. Mm-hmm. But I really think it would work better as a TV series. Just because, like, I think if you're world building, especially if you just want to just, you know, go on and extend things, I think it's a lot easier to do more authentically on television where you have a lot of time in which to do it. And I think if you were spending more time, like some episodes where you were just in the Capitol dealing with the politics, it would feel more authentic.
Yeah.
And that way when you would get to the spaces like the actual games themselves, which could be during Sweeps Month, then it would, the sort of inauthenticity of it would feel right as well, because that is inauthentic. You know, they are in these engineered environments that are specifically just to test them, you know?
What yeah. you're bringing us dangerously close to is the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. version of the Hunger Games, which I'm not sure anybody actually wants.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking he's like bringing us close to like the Battlestar Galactica version of the Hunger Games, which I think I'd be totally into. Like that people come in and out at different times, and it doesn't have to feel quite as unified because you're moving all over the place. But yeah, well, I don't know. I guess I'll backpedal and I'll say like when you guys are saying you're more impressed by the production values, do you mean like the like when we go from sort of district to district at the beginning, or did you mean like the arena internally or the whole thing?
I was talking about the rendering of the Capitol this time, which I thought was much, much fuller. I think we see more of it. I think you get a better sense for what the environment of the Capitol is in this and the people in it. Whereas I think the first one sort of sped by that so quickly, just in that one parade, that Olympic style parade or whatever. I feel like you get more of a sense of the decadence of it and the shallowness of it in this.
Mm-hmm.
The district, the sort of tour through the districts, it's as much of a blur in the movie as it is in the book, frankly, and that was something I was hoping we'd get maybe a little bit more of in this book, because it did seem like, just from watching the trailer, that the book was going to flesh out certain things that the book didn't. And it does, in some ways, in like Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, I feel like does not have as much of a presence in the books as it does in the movie, and I think things make much more sense because of it. But I think once you get into the arena and they put together the characters that they have together, and again, this might be just something where like I read the book, so I have more affection for these characters from the break. So like I don't have to build up, you know, in my mind, affection for Jeffrey Wright's character, or Amanda Plummer's character, that kind of thing. And maybe it is in a movie where, you know, for, you know, a movie trying to stand on its own 2 feet, that it's, you don't get enough time with those people.
I guess for me, I have the same problem with it that I had with Harry Potter. It's like, I do feel like when people are watching it, because the books they're based on are such phenomenon, that they are bringing so much with them into the theater, because the movies just don't, you know, just stand as standalone things. They just like I thought Johanna was entertaining in the movie. Don't get me wrong. Like I, like Johanna and Finnick were probably my favorite parts. But I got the sense even in those characterizations that oh, this was probably a fan favorite in the book, and they're probably projecting a lot onto it because there was really very little of them.
I had problems with Harry Potter, but that was mostly in terms of talking about world building, that the world of Harry Potter was so much denser. And what I like about the Hunger Games movies is that the books themselves are kind of, they're not thin. They're, I mean, there's less plot in them. There's fewer characters than in Harry Potter, but I feel like they do a really good job of visualizing a lot of the stuff that you like about the books and then bringing, it makes more of an argument for telling the story on screen than the Harry Potter movies ever did for me. And I would take the Harry Potter books over the Hunger Games books any day, so that might be part of the issue. Yeah. And I do think that even though you don't get a lot of time with Johanna or Finnick, or really anybody, that there's really good use of filmmaking just to establish these characters. And this happens especially for PETA, who I think, I mean, he kind of suffers just as being a really inactive character, but they did a really good job of just taking a minute and giving you a shot to see why this character is worthwhile. And that really set this apart from the first movie.
I was just going to say, I feel like that in that sense, the casting of Josh Hutcherson makes much more sense now and feels much better now in that he's such a little guy. He's such like an insignificant seeming guy. And there's, I think if they had cast somebody who was a lot sort of more classically, you know, heroic, then all of a sudden the PETA character becomes like unrealistically ridiculous, where it's just like that Vulture article where the whole thing was just like, what, 13 ways that PETA screws up.
Yeah, you had one job.
And it was just like, and that's, I feel like that's not necessarily unintentional in the movie. Yeah. I think there is a sense that this is a meek little, you know, he's the, whatever, he's the bread maker. He's not cut out for this world. And I think that is underlined in the casting of Josh Hutcherson, and the contrast between him and Katniss within the games along those lines is really good. And then you see it even more contrasted when you've got Finnick and Johanna there, who are like total badasses.
Nick, I thought their scene at is it District 11 where Rue is from?
District 11, yes.
Give the speech and go off script. Like, I thought that was a pretty great scene, and that was an example for me of what you're talking about, the getting much more invested in, and not just the relationship, but just the dynamics between the two of them, and between the two of them and the rest of the world and what they're supposed to be and whatever. I thought that scene was pretty great.
Yeah, I mean, I really like the character of Peeta, but I think that's just because I, you know, get so worked up about gender politics in movies, and I really love that there's like a sensitive male character that's like somebody you're supposed to root for, and that a female character really values.
Yeah,
like for as much as she has ambivalence about everything, she does really value him.
Oh yeah, totally, absolutely.
Even though he's his, you know, he's not, you know, the typical.
Yeah, I almost think that the whole stuff, like, I don't know if I can put this on the books or the movies or whatever, but it just comes so close to being able to being a story about her having different feelings about these two guys in her life that they don't feel plausibly romantic to me in either case. And I kind of wish they didn't have to get packaged that way, because I just think we're really close to having a movie about a woman who has different thoughts about the different people that she's close to and different reasons for feeling loyal to them. And that would be more than enough. And in fact, something we almost never get. And then the minute that they ever try to sell me on it as love, in any case, I feel weird and kind of lied to.
Strong words.
No, I think
the Hunger Games lies. No, but that's what's so good about her performance, I think, is that I think she understands that. Because she's not the one selling that.
That's true. Almost in that George Clooney way where I'm not positive that Jennifer Lawrence can totally sell me on being in love with somebody else. Like, I haven't yet seen that in one of her movies, so I'm curious to see if I'll ever see that. But
rather than just herself, you mean?
Well, I mean, I'm not the only person, a horrible narcissist, but I just think that like that there's a certain kind of charismatic self-confidence that I think she and Clooney kind of have in common. Mm-hmm. Julia Roberts is a little bit this way too, where it's an interesting challenge to see them actually totally give themselves over to a second person. I'm curious if that will happen at the end of this series.
And that actually does suit Katniss, too. Like, she's somebody who is looking out for the people she's close to, but it's not in a way that really... She doesn't really think about love nearly as much as everybody else around her. I mean, and you see with Gale, with hunky Liam Hemsworth, you know, he kisses her, and she kind of doesn't really know what to do with that and doesn't really do anything with that because she's got other shit to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did all of the charisma in the Hemsworth family go to Chris, though?
Like, I don't know.
Honestly.
It's really an unfair imbalance.
It's like he leached it off of his brother while they were children or something like that. It's just, and I don't think Liam Hemsworth is terrible necessarily, but it's just the charisma deficit between the two of them is significant.
Mm-hmm. We're back in the Joseph Fiennes place. It's like, oh, sweetie.
Or the fictionalized version in A River Runs Through It. Do you guys remember that? Yeah. Brad Pitt and his brother.
Oh, he's the Henry Thomas.
They all belong to the Lorna Luft Society. Annual meetings.
Give us an hour and a half and we'll bring it back to Judy and... Oh, man, that's so funny.
Judy G. Okay, so should we move on to Philomena?
Yeah.
Now, Katie, you haven't seen this, so you can grill us.
Yeah, and all I know about it is that, I mean, I kind of, it was on my radar, obviously, and then when I was in Wisconsin for Thanksgiving, so many people were asking me about this, like all these like random aunts. So it's
random ants is the demographic for this movie.
I know, like these are like people who I just don't even think of seeing movies. Like they've seen Gravity and that's it. So
their marketing has been successful then.
I guess so. It's a hit the ant demographic for sure.
Well, that's who was in the theater when I saw it. There was also a lot of people working for some sort of political organization huddled around the theater with signs, you know, like about wanting adoption laws changed.
Oh wow.
Yeah, there was like a big, you know, I mean, they were in support of the movie, but they were still trying to use it for leverage, you know.
So I guess here's my big question is I see how this is a performance for Judi Dench. I see how this is the kind of thing that could get her attention. Is this as a movie overall that interesting?
Well, Rex Reed thinks it's the best film of the year.
Does he really?
Filmmaking on a monumental level, that's his quote.
I wonder if Katie still has the exact same question that she did before.
Yeah, Rex Reed, as goes Rex Reed, so goes the nation usually, so I guess that's it.
Well, so goes the Oscars. He has very similar taste.
It's an interesting story, I feel like. I think the fact that it's a true story makes it a little bit more interesting, which always makes me slightly suspicious of a movie, that if the fact that it's true is an enhancement, maybe it shouldn't have to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Do you know what I'm
As
saying?
As in, like, but, it kind of tides you through some implausibilities to be like, well, uh-huh. I guess it really happened, so I guess
yeah.
Yeah.
There is a level of inconsistency in the tone where it can be really glib at times.
Yeah.
In a way that doesn't serve the rest of the movie very well. I should say that I saw this with my parents and my sister last night, and my parents loved it. It got
key two demographic. Thumbs up with parents and aunts.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. I felt like there could have been a little more or a little less. It could have been making this subject matter more comedic is probably a challenge that was beyond Stephen Frears and the people involved in this movie. But certainly then maybe make it a little less sort of your requisite comedy beats every 7 minutes or so, just to make sure that nobody's feeling too sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It definitely did have that... a lot of tonal shifting going on, but more than that, it felt to me like a little bit padded, which is a weird thing to say about a long journey. Like, because it's obviously about her sort of like lifelong sort of dreams. For those who don't know, the story is about this woman whose child was given up for adoption and her wondering about him for 50 years. So the story is obviously like only takes... place in the late years of her life because it's Judi Dench, but she's, finally doing something about wondering. She's trying to find him. But given that, like, not a lot actually happens in terms of plot. So it did feel like, does it want to be a comedy about, like, sort of Brits, in America, like, sort of killing time? Like, there were weird passages where I thought, I don't know what this movie is.
Yeah.
But it's very, very easy to watch. Like, it's a super sort of, like, easy sit.
Yeah, I think it's, like, an interesting case for, like, thinking about what editing is for. Because, like, I think there's a way of thinking that a 98-minute movie must be really well edited and a 4-hour movie must be really badly edited. And, like, and I was actually kind of often impressed by the direction in this movie more than, like, what Frears did in The Queen, insofar as he only needed really short scenes or single shots to get you through a whole stage of things that were happening. Like, there is a kind of rhythm and kind of fleetness to the movie that I thought The Queen sort of didn't have. But then, like Nathaniel's saying, there are these shots that, like there's a moment where she goes back to the convent where she lived for a while when she was young, and you get, like, 8 shots that are there to show you that she remembers when she used to live there. It's like, yes, probably does. She remembers that this was the gate where she was standing when her child was driven away. I bet she does remember. I also remember that because that was 60 seconds ago. Everybody remembers that. So, like, it is, like, weirdly a kind of, like, padded 98-minute movie, even though I think it really moves. But there's a lot that just doesn't kind of need to be there. Unless they're trying to make it not a 75-minute movie.
Well, and there's an inconsistency around the whole idea of the narrative thrust behind once she finds out who her son was and sort of what his life was. Whether she's feeling a parallel with his life and hers, and that sort of seems to exist for a second there and then sort of gets forgotten. It just sort of falls back on the easy, like, he was my son and I was taken away from me. And it seemed for a second there like it was going to get a little bit more interesting in terms of the intellect of the movie and how we were going to think about her life and we were going to think about his life. And I thought we were going to get a little bit more with the people who knew him instead of just sort of the little, like, tour of people. And by the way, I just found out this last night when I came home, the guy who plays
Peter?
What's his name? Peter, yes. Was Liz Lemon in the episode of 30 Rock where Liz Lemon almost makes out with her cousin when she finds out later, like third cousins. It was that guy. And I was trying to figure out forever. I was like, I know this guy from something. Like,
he's the hair.
And he's the hair. Exactly. Thank you, Katie. He's the hair.
That's my contribution for you.
But yeah, I just felt like a little bit more cohesion. This is sort of how I felt with Frozen too, not to bring another movie into this thing, but just a couple more passes on the story and on the script might have really, really tightened things up.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think, and like, I don't want to, you know, sound mean or anything, but one of my problems with it, even though I liked it, was,
yeah, I liked it too.
Steve Coogan.
Mm.
Like, I feel
the performance?
Yeah, I just feel like, I mean, obviously he co-wrote it, right? His contribution is obviously major to the movie because he's the co-star and the co-writer, but I feel like performance-wise he's not giving me a lot. Like, he's definitely not overacting, but I just, like, this is a rare case where I want to complain about underacting. I was just like, help me to feel something different other than you just, like, looking at Dench and wondering why she's so timid, you know?
Yeah.
To me, he got across.
I need more thorniness, I guess, is what I'm saying, in my relation. If a movie's going to be about two characters traveling together and, you know, just talking for, you know, an hour and a half, I want the textures to be more interesting within the back and forth.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird part for him in that way. Like, it's hard to, you know, fault somebody for writing themselves a part or giving themselves the role when they wrote the script. But, like, but there is a sense. I mean, I think Steve Coogan is so, in all of his movies, kind of weirdly tempted to make himself seem as unattractive as possible. Like, he's just so interested in, like, in being dislikable in a way, or showing you that he's, like, pulling away from you as an audience member, even though he's kind of a show-off in other ways. And, like, that all definitely happens again in this. And it's kind of an interesting juxtaposition with what Judi Dench is doing, but maybe not ever as interesting as it could be. Or I guess I agree with you that it remains interesting to think what somebody else might have done in the part.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so hard to think of being in a desperate circumstance where you're like, gosh, I wonder who will, like, put my needs over their own needs. Probably Steve Coogan. Like, well, no, probably not. Just a guess.
Right.
But there were, like, what Joe was saying about the script, where things kind of seem interesting for a second and then they kind of recede. Like, I kept going back and forth about whether that was a flaw or kind of interesting about the script.
Me too.
Like, because another way, so you one thing you find out about the son was that he was gay. And then you kind of find out that that's not a surprise to her, even though she didn't know him after he was, like, four.
Right.
And there's almost a way in which I thought you could take the whole adoption angle aside for a second and just think of it as kind of a sort of interesting movie about how, in my experience, like, the mothers of gay men often never stop feeling like they did something wrong or worry that they are resented or misunderstood, and, like, gay men seem to often have a thing about their mother. Like there was an interesting way in which it was about a mother and a gay son who were both kind of blocked off from each other but kind of always interested in reaching out to each other, and both of them like the other person probably sees them as the problem. Like,
even in their external lives, where she grew up feeling like she had made this great sin against herself and against everybody, and he's in the Republican Party as a gay man, not being able to be out. Like, there was a lot of ways that really could have blossomed, and the fact that, which made the moments where, I mean, she's making, like, quips about, like, AIDS, and I'm just sort of like, no, why are we being so glib in these scenes? Like, this could really be something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
at the same time, it's amazing that those analogies weren't more belabored than they were. Like,
right, that's my struggle, is because sometimes I like the fact that it's not underlined so much, but I just feel like, I think it was less that it was letting the audience make the connections ourselves than it was sort of dropping it and abandoning it.
I guess, I mean, give me straight up Oscars. Like, is Dench good enough to, get a ton of heat for this, or is she just good because she's Judi Dench?
think it's somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah, the voters clearly love her, and I think this is a performance that is more than capable of getting a nomination from them. And I mean, she carries the movie, and that goes a long way. Mm-hmm. It's not an exciting performance in that it's not something that you've never seen her do before.
Right.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, in that way, there's more of a push for Sandra Bullock and maybe even an Emma Thompson. But would not be surprised at all to see her get nominated. I think she stands a very good shot.
I think it's kind of her On Golden Pond performance. Like, you definitely know she can do it. That's probably going to mean that it gets less credit than it deserves in some quarters, but, you know, it's probably already getting more than it really needs. She's really good, but it's not the biggest stretch in the world.
I think she'll get nominated for it. People who are hoping for one of the, like, many edgier critical darlings this year are going to be disappointed, because I think the lineup's fairly set.
It's going to be the all-winners lineup.
Yep.
But I think what's going to be interesting is that what happens with the movie, because it does seem like it has that, in the way it appeals to everybody's aunts and everybody's parents, like, it could easily be a kind of blindsidey, like, this is such a bullseye for a certain kind of audience that doesn't feel all that well served by a lot of other quote-unquote Oscar movies. And I wouldn't be stunned to see it kind of get more nominations all over the place than, like, screenplay, maybe even picture.
Yeah.
I feel like the Weinstein Company has its attention so scattered this season, though. Figuring out how they're going to focus their attention will be very interesting.
I think that every year, and then they manage to have a huge attention for everything anyway.
They prove to be much more capable and multi-tentacled. Yeah, maybe.
Well, and they also do the winnowing process that any studio with a lot of stuff does, where it seems very, like, shotgun at first, and then they train their sights on the wins, you know?
Yeah, that's true. That is the nomination that could have gone to Julia Roberts if they had more courage in pushing two female leads out of Augusto Sage County.
Yeah.
Joe, did you notice that the dead son is the hot priest from Higher Ground?
That's who that was.
Which is why, you know, he was a Finnick to me, and I realized I already loved him even before the movie started. I only love you.
You don't I need knew to have he looked seen. Familiar.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, now it's all coming together, is it not?
It did especially help that I watched these movies back to back at 8 o'clock and 10 o'clock. They work as a double feature. Philomena.
Oh my gosh! How funny.
If only Philomena could have been the Lynn Cohen character in The Hunger Games.
Everybody totally could have come. Was. Now I'm looking at his IMDb page. You're absolutely right. That's amazing. That's a good catch.
I'll say he's a good catch.
There.
Well, apparently, in the book, this is what I've read at least, it's really, there's a lot about his character, about the son.
About his life. Oh, yeah, interesting.
About his life. And
I was fairly bummed that Michelle Fairley got such a one-dimensional, one-note character. I mean, I guess it's
the Mary Steenburgen / Allison Janney part.
Yes, absolutely, totally. And I love her so much from Game of Thrones. And I guess it's not, you know, that there's only so far that character, that type of character can go. But
yeah,
I'm hoping to see her in more and better roles in other movies in the future.
Although
She was the editor.
Although we
have a cold-hearted, business-minded editor.
Although we have to give another shout-out we already have on this podcast, but to... her name's escaping me, from Side Effects.
Polly Draper.
Because you can really pop in those roles.
Yeah.
It's just like you have to have like...
Oh, I thought you were saying she was in this movie. I was like,
No. I just mean like that character, it's in like so many movies. And it's usually played by Steenburgen Janney or, you know, some random British woman.
In Salmon Fishing in the Yemen, it was played by Kristen Scott Thomas.
Yeah.
There we go. Nice.
But I think sometimes...
I'd like to get that back in there.
But sometimes if you come at it from a new angle, a new casting angle, the people can pop.
Yeah, that is totally true.
That's just my shout-out to casting directors to keep an open mind.
You said Edmure Winningham's in this for one scene of nothing.
Yes. Yeah,
she's
I didn't
so
really...
still.
I guess that's why I didn't... Some of my problems with the movie involve how truncated that those final half hour is.
Because
it seems like that's where a lot of the interesting stuff has happened, and that's and there's no padding in those. There's not enough. So it's like, I get what Nick's saying about the editing and that it moves very swiftly, which is totally true. But I feel like the balance is really weird. Like, all the interesting stuff happens at the end, and it's like sort of, you just shoot through it. Like, I wanted to understand what those characters were feeling about Philomena.
Yeah.
You know?
That'd be a good thing for a movie called Philomena to be clearer about. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, like, especially, I mean, I don't want to go too many spoilers, but her last sort of, like, interview in America, that build up to that scene and where that scene goes made no sense. Cause,
mystifying. Yeah.
It made no sense because they weren't giving you anything about that character as to why the character would react that way.
Yeah.
Why the character changes his mind, you know,
yes.
All that stuff.
Yeah, that really sort of is pushed through very quickly.
Vague, but it needed to be said.
It's a good movie that had it in it to be a good bit better.
Yeah.
There you go, Katie.
All right, I will report back once I've seen it. I'm sure I will.
It's
see
not
it.
An Iron Lady, Katie. You can see it.
I'm going to see the Iron Lady. I'm just going to surprise you guys and watch it like next July when no one expects it.
You're going to hijack a podcast. You're like, today we're talking about the Iron Lady. Like,
surprise!
I was a little bit proud about calling you the Great Iron Lady yesterday.
Oh, I was incredibly proud of that. That was amazing.
I was watching American Hustle while you guys were having that conversation.
Oh, sure you were.
Actually watching Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 2.
Well, I'll report back once I've seen Philomena.
All
yes,
right.
Report back detailed-wise and make it snappy and make it give it a hook. We need a hero and a villain and we need a hook.
Alright.
See it with some evil nuns, Katie. That'll make it better.
Okay.
Well, how about this for randomness, the sign-off? Your favorite evil nun from a movie?
Oh, my God.
Oh, God.
Is there a choice other than Black Narcissus?
There's plenty of evil nuns in the movies.
Well, that was the first one that came to my mind.
That's a good one, though. So, thanks for tuning in. My favorite evil nun is Vanessa Redgrave from The Devils.
Nice.
Oh, is she evil? I guess she is. Yeah. I bought a DVD at the used store called Killer Nun. I'm looking at it right now. I had never heard of it before, but how do you not buy something called Killer Nun? And it stars Joe D'Alessandro from all those Andy Warhol movies.
Uh-huh.
Oh my.
And the back says that it's a notorious nunsploitation based on actual events that took place in a Central European country not many years ago.
Oh my gosh.
So notorious.
Branded as obscene around the world and banned outright in Britain.
So notorious, you've never heard of it.
That's right. About a cruel nun who discovers depraved pleasure in a frenzy of drug addiction, sexual degradation, and sadistic murder.
Hey,
so I think this is already my favorite evil nun.
You're totally stealing my answer. That sounds like The Devils.
Well, I'm going to totally cheat and say that mine is Lily Rabe from American Horror Story Asylum because she's just too good to deny.
I'm enjoying her so much on Coven.
Yeah, she's wonderful. I love her.
She was
my good. Other answer is those bitches who don't like Maria at the beginning of The Sound of Music.
I was going to say, like, Kathy and Jimmy.
Including Marnie
Nixon,
Nick.
Really going on.
Yeah. digression, though. Who's watching the live Sound of Music next week?
I suppose.
I just want to be in the room.
I think my roommates are having a thing.
With Nick's partner, Derek. To see
yeah,
his
we're having a big...
Her.
That's a heavy decision that he sits with every morning for the last couple weeks. We don't know what to do. I was just amazed he knew who Carrie Underwood was.
Yeah. Well, given his love for Sound of Music, will he consider it blasphemy or will he watch so really excited to watch it?
For people who don't know, Derek, when he was six, had to be carried out of a dinner theater in Ohio because he started screaming at the beginning of The Sound of Music because the woman came out and she was brunette. And so, much like Annie Wilkes in Misery, he just started screaming, "That's not Maria! That's not Maria! That's not Maria!" And it was an hour and a half from his house, and his mother had saved up for months to be able to take him to this, and it was a fiasco. So,
oh my gosh.
So absolutely anything could happen if we actually watched that thing.
But Carrie Underwood is blonde.
That's a good start. But more than that, I cannot predict.
And that's a wrap for this week. Next week, we will have a lot to catch up on the Globe nominations, SAG nominations. It should be exciting. See you Sunday.
She climbs a tree and scrapes her knee. Her dress has got a tear. She waltzes on her way to mass and whistles on the stair. And underneath her wimple, she has curlers in her hair. I've even heard her singing in the abbey. She's always late for chapel, but her penitence is real. She's always late for everything, except for every meal. I hate to have to say it, but I very firmly feel Maria's not an asset to the Abbey. I'd like to say a word in her behalf. Maria makes me laugh. How do you solve a problem like Maria? How do you catch a cloud and pin it down? How do you find a word that means Maria? A flippity-tibbit, a will-o'-the-wisp, a clown. Many a thing you know you'd like to tell her. Many a thing she ought to understand. But how do you make her stay and listen to all you say? How do you keep a wave upon the sand? Oh, how do you solve a problem like Maria?